Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we're coming to you today from the Foreign Ministry of the Russian Federation. This is a very important place and a place with a history. If these walls could only talk, you could imagine. As I walk the halls of this building, I see names and images of people that we as Americans have all grown up watching. Speaking for myself as an American, Gromyko, Trotsky, Shevardnadze, the people who've been involved in the decisions between the rest of the world and Russia for so many years. That's why I think it's so important for me as an American journalist to be able to be here today to bring you this special edition of the Sanchez Effect from the Russian Foreign Ministry. And I am joined right now by the foreign minister himself, who's good enough to join us and give us his time, Mr. Sergei Lavrov. Mr. Lavrov, thank you so much for joining us, sir. It is such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I guess we have to start with some of the things that are going on right now. And I think probably the most important thing has to be taking place in Europe. And let me ask you this, because I was kind of taken aback when I saw this. Recently, the Chancellor of Germany, Friedrich Merz, said that Russia is the largest country in all of Europe. And then he went on to make it sound as if he's inviting Russia to be back of the European community. But this is the same man who just recently seemed to almost be wanting to go to war with Russia. What did you make of his comments?
Over the past month and a half, many European politicians have been talking about relations with the Russian Federation. Until recently, they spoke in unison, demanding firmness, insisting on unwavering support for Ukraine, continued arms shipments, sustained financing, all to ensure Russia's defeat, a strategic defeat on the battlefield. Then they changed their tune. They realized it was all an illusion. Their planners, their military strategists who had orchestrated this operation, who had prepared Ukrainians to fight and die advancing European interests against Russia, they finally understood that these plans had collapsed. No one had learned anything from history. Napoleon's attempt, Hitler's attempt, and once again they rallied practically all of Europe under those same banners. Only this time, unlike Napoleon and Hitler, not yet as soldiers on the battlefield, but as donors, sponsors, arms suppliers, ideological leaders. Under those same banners, the Ukrainian army was thrown into battle alongside mercenaries from various countries and official NATO instructors. We all know about this. And this latest attempt has led to the same outcome as Napoleon's and Hitler's misadventures. But the West learns history poorly. We see this especially in Germany, which you mentioned. After several relatively quiet years under Angela Merkel, followed by that rather murky period under Chancellor Scholz, Friedrich Merz came to power and made some striking statements that deserve some serious consideration. He announced that he was lifting constitutional restrictions on military spending, then declared this was necessary for Germany to once again, I emphasize that word, once again, become Europe's dominant military power. This speaks volumes about his mindset and the direction of his thinking. Since then, he has repeated this idea in various forms and in practice. What he's doing amounts to preparation for war. The same thing has been happening in France, where President Macron has repeatedly insisted that Ukraine cannot lose. I won't even get into what the British under Starmer or, of course, Ursula von der Leyen and Mark Rutte. Yes, Merz recently said something about Russia being Europe's largest country. Let me correct that right away. Russia is the largest country in Eurasia, not just Europe, and indeed the world. But what concerns us here is Eurasia as a continent. Every attempt so far to establish security in this space has focused exclusively on the western part of Eurasia, so-called Europe. All these security frameworks have been built around the Euro-Atlantic concept, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance. The Americans never wanted to leave the Europeans on their own, and they still don't. They simply want Europeans to foot the bill for their own military preparations and buy American weapons, but lose oversight of their NATO allies? Washington has no intention of that. Then came the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which symbolized the shift from Cold War to peaceful coexistence, equality, consensus, decisions made only by mutual agreement, and much more. That the OSCE has completely discredited itself hardly needs saying now. Everyone can see it. Back when the Soviet Union was collapsing and the Warsaw Pact was dissolving, there were voices saying NATO should be disbanded too. That instead of NATO and the Warsaw Pact, we should strengthen the OSCE as our collective framework based on an honest, equal balance of interests. They remember that now. It never happened, of course, because neither the United States nor Britain nor other leading NATO members had any intention of dissolving the alliance. Instead, they embraced what Francis Fukuyama called the end of history. The end of history, liberal ideology would reign, democracy in its Western form, NATO as the universal guarantor of security. Now, that would dominate. This psychology naturally led to the current situation. But as the Euro-Atlantic structures weakened, I'll note parenthetically that the European Union has also become a NATO appendage. They even signed a document to that effect. Germany began reasserting itself, and this alarms not only us, but many EU member states. Opposition is growing, along with determination not to let Germany once again subjugate everyone else, especially since Merz and his government openly link this German revival to militarization and war preparation. Their defense minister, Pistorius, keeps pointing out to 2029 to 2030 as the deadline by which they must be ready for war with Russia. I don't know who they're trying to convince that Russia would actually attack them. Knowing history should be enough to keep such foolish notions out of your head. But consider the arguments we hear from Europeans. Russia is weakened. Russia is barely advancing across Ukrainian territory. Russia gains a teaspoon of land per day. Russia is failing. Fifth year of war and so on. Massive losses. Russia is struggling, forced to overcome gaps in various weapon systems, or so they write. They paint this picture for their voters of a militarily and economically exhausted Russia, then immediately, with no logical bridge whatsoever, leap to the conclusion that we must prepare for the same Russia to attack us. If you're going to portray us as a broken, depleted country, at least have enough imagination to manipulate your voters more elegantly. As for these conversations you mentioned, which have emerged not only in Germany, Macron announced yet again about 2 weeks ago that he might call Putin sometime. You know, that's not serious. It's pathetic diplomacy. If you want to call and have a real conversation, just call. Putin will always answer the phone. He'll always listen to any proposal. And if serious proposals are on the table, I can assure you that they won't go without a serious, concrete, practical response. I won't hide it. We do have contacts with some European leaders. They call us and ask that these conversations not be made public. Some even show up here and communicate through back channels. But nothing they tell us about their ideas in these closed, confidential exchanges differs in any way from what they say publicly. The same appeals. Let's wrap this up. Something has to be done. They just kept saying the same things. Let's bring it to a close. Let's do something. I don't see Europe taking up any real position. They've walked into their own trap by adopting this uncompromising stance that I mentioned earlier, when they insisted on Russia's strategic defeat, saying Ukraine cannot lose, Russia cannot win, or else Europe loses face. And all they're doing now is trying to sabotage, to subvert the negotiations that finally began taking shape between Russia and the United States. And now they're joined by Ukrainian representatives.
It almost sounds like you're saying we have been burned so many times that we have a hard time right now with trust. When you consider the fact that in the early 90s, Russia did everything possible to align itself with the United States, with the West, that Mr. Putin and yourself have talked about even joining NATO. And now it seems that even though I talk to the Russian people since I've been reporting here, I don't feel a sense of antagonism against Europe from Russians, but I feel a sense of antagonism from Europe against the Russians, right? The Russians don't feel antagonistic against Europe, but the Europeans feel antagonistic against the Russians. What are you at the point now where the position of Russia is? We've been burned so many times. We have been deceived so many times. We're just not willing to come to the table, at least not on your terms. We have to set the terms. Is that kind of where you are right now?
To a large extent, yes, though perhaps it was not as stripped to the core. The most important thing is that you just said we absolutely got burned putting our trust in those people who swore that NATO would not expand eastward, that none of Russia's interests would be hurt, and that we would enjoy a common space from Lisbon to Vladivostok, and that this entire vast continent would be a continent of peace and security. We established the NATO-Russia Council together with them in an effort to maintain constant dialogue and build trust. so that we could share information of interest about our armed forces within the NATO-Russia Council's framework. We talked about initiatives and transparency. And yet when NATO lost its reason for existence, then rediscovered that purpose in Afghanistan, and then that project in Afghanistan ended in a huge failure with the entire global community watching, they needed a new purpose. So they pulled themselves together, did some thinking, and came up with the plan that's unrolling now, that Russia must be declared a rogue state. And to make that happen, Ukraine was the perfect candidate that could be handled by the West in any way they like, especially since they'd been grooming it ever since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. All those promises not to expand NATO, not to come close to the Russian borders, all of that was forgotten. They've been literally grooming Ukraine since the 1990s, investing billions of dollars into this project. Victoria Nuland recently admitted that the final preparations for the coup d'etat in February 2014 cost $5 billion. I am convinced that the total amount invested in the Ukrainian project since its independence is much bigger. When Ukraine declared independence, its declaration stated clearly that it would always be neutral, non-nuclear, non-aligned country. And when Russia recognized Ukraine's independence in 1991, we recognized it precisely as such, as a non-aligned, neutral, and non-nuclear state. Therefore, we have absolutely nothing to blame ourselves for. Everyone recognized it as such, including the West. But then the West began to shape this country into what it thought it needed, as opposed to what it was supposed to be, according to its own declaration of independence adopted by the Ukrainian people.
Do you tell them that when, you know, obviously I don't want you to share the specifics of your conversations with other foreign ministers and other heads of state in Europe and in the United States, but do you say to them, look, all we want is a neutral Ukraine. They don't have to be pro-Russian. They don't have to be pro-anything. We just want a neutral Ukraine. We want to be respected. And by the way, we have no intention of bombing you. We have no intention of going to war with Russia. We have no intention of going with Europe. We have no intentions of going to war, period, which is what they keep telling the world. They say Russia is very aggressive. And Russia is saying, we're not aggressive.
Well, they say all sorts of things to the global community, don't they? Just recently, they were saying that none of them had ever been to Epstein's Island. That's how they are. So far as Ukraine is concerned, of course, we have told them all this. Moreover, we presented them with a vast amount of evidence of our very restrained policies, although there were situations when such restraint was perceived by our own people as unjustified or even as a weakness. For example, if we speak of the first Maidan protest, the first coup d'etat of 2004, when Leonid Kuchma was president, who had very good relations with President Putin, they consulted each other on all issues. I can say that I was in President Putin's office when his phone rang, and it was the Ukrainian president calling to say, the West has thousands of people out protesting in Independence Square. They've set up tents. They're waving flags and saying they won't recognize the results of the presidential election. They're against them. What should I do? They have weapons. That's what President Kuchma said, and he asked Putin, what should I do? And President Putin said, but you're the president, Mr. Kuchma. If the law is being violated, you have your constitution, and you surely have the measures approved by your parliament for dealing with violations of the law. But President Kuchma did not want to use force in any way. He chose not to show determination, sticking to the law. And so, in contradiction to the Ukrainian law, he let the Constitutional Court announce a third round of the presidential election, even though there was no such option under the Ukrainian constitution or any other Ukrainian law. They let a third round of the presidential election happen solely because the West had financed the Maidan protests. I remember it very well. It was my first year as foreign minister. And back then, many European leaders, including foreign ministers, publicly stated Ukrainians must choose. Either they are with Russia or they are with Europe. That was their position. No more talk of a common space from the Atlantic to the Pacific. All that was scrapped and forgotten. They presented Ukraine with a choice, either or. We are Europe, and over there is Russia. Either you go there, or you join us. And essentially, that was a coup d'etat. And yet Russia was willing to work with the president, who was essentially appointed by the West as he emerged victorious in the third round of the election. It was Viktor Yushchenko, who was absolutely pro-Western, who had an American wife who was open both about her citizenship and the fact whose interests she was promoting as the First Lady of Ukraine. And yet Russia still worked with Yushchenko and traded gas and even managed to reach an agreement on energy cooperation with Prime Minister Tymoshenko at the time, despite the obviously pro-Western slant of the Ukrainian leadership. We were ready to work even with those who staged yet another coup in February 2014, when President Yanukovych and the Putschists signed an agreement, and they did sign an agreement which called for early elections, and until then there would be an interim national unity government. The West guaranteed this deal. France, Germany, Poland and Obama called Putin. Vladimir, please don't discourage Yanukovych from signing. To which Putin said, if a legitimate president decides this is the way to bring peace and stability to his country, how could I possibly object? And then, barely 24 hours later, there was a coup. We asked the Americans, what was that about? You asked us to help make this deal happen. It was signed by all parties. And the next thing you know, your people are storming government buildings with guns. The Americans just dodged the question entirely. The Germans and French, who had guaranteed the agreement, just shrugged, looked away sheepishly and said, well, you know, sometimes democracy takes unexpected twists. And the very first thing this new regime did was strip the Russian language of its official status. The second thing they did was send armed thugs to storm the Crimean parliament. And because both Crimea and the Donbass had said, we want nothing to do with you, you're illegitimate, you tore up the deal with our legitimate president. These people were called terrorists, even though they never fired a shot, they just wanted to be left alone. Then the regime started using warplanes and artillery on its own territory, which is a clear violation of international humanitarian law. And when all this kicked off, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the NATO Secretary General, who had pleaded with Yanukovych 100 times not to use the army against his own people, suddenly started calling on the Putschists to use proportionate force against anyone who wouldn't accept the coup. And here's the thing, when the West tells the story of this crisis, they start the clock in mid-March, when Crimea voted to rejoin Russia. That's where it all began, according to them. Everything was fine, then the Russians showed up, held a referendum, and that's when the trouble started. So, once again, we learned the hard way that the West doesn't keep its word. A year later, after heavy fighting, came the Minsk agreements. Merkel, Hollande, Putin, Poroshenko. They sat through the night, worked 17 hours straight, signed the deal, got it endorsed by the UN Security Council. And then Ukraine just refused to hold up its end, always pointing fingers at the other side. Zelensky does the same thing now. Any talk of a ceasefire, and it's always Russia's fault somehow. But we still gave them the benefit of the doubt. And then, years later, Merkel and Hollande openly admitted that the Minsk Accords were only ever meant to buy time so they could arm Ukraine. You know, there's a Russian saying, the Russian man takes a long time to harness his horses, but once he's done, he rides very fast. And in that same spirit, we were still willing to trust the situation that took shape 2 weeks into the special military operation. In April 2022, at the Istanbul talks, we actually agreed to what the Ukrainians proposed. Then they were told to walk away. Boris Johnson, and I'm sure other Europeans, had a hand in it too. So we've developed a kind of tolerance. That's not the right word, but real insight into how these situations unfold. And the fact that none of this has taught our European colleagues anything, with very few exceptions, that's absolutely true.
That's an important story that you just shared, because you just took us through an explanation of what was deceitful, planned, a coup, and, as many now understand, a provocation on the part of the West. But in the West, the only story that often people hear is Russia bullied its way into Ukraine. Russia was the aggressor. And it's important, sir, that, and I know you're adamant and passionate about often telling that story, because we mention, you know, the story of the big story that's taking place in the United States right now. I'm just wondering as well, the type of people we're learning now who were involved in this horrible Epstein thing, these people who were deceitful, somewhat decrepit, is this the same kind of person who have led to what happened in Ukraine, to the coup in Ukraine, to the deceit in Ukraine? Would you say that that's the same kind of person, or maybe even some of the exact people.
And I don't think you can make sweeping generalizations about specific individuals. But as for what people call the deep state, these shadowy funds and secretive groups supposedly pulling the strings of world affairs, I'm skeptical. At the end of the day, elected presidents and prime ministers do have plenty of power to set their own course. And if they all choose a path built on deception, one that means they've lost the capacity to feel shame, to blush when caught lying to a partner, well, that's just a fact. There are plenty of people like that. And right now, they're on full display across Europe, and they learn nothing. Look, another round of military talks between Russia and Ukraine is getting underway. American representatives will be there, Witkoff, Kushner, and just yesterday, of all places in Britain, the Financial Times runs a story saying that Russia is about to be handed something close to an ultimatum, a document on security guarantees for Ukraine already agreed upon. Now, these security guarantees would mean that if Russia ever dares to attack Ukraine again, or if they, the clever ones, cook up some false flag provocation to pin on Russia, then within 24 hours, they condemn it and give Ukraine the green light to keep fighting. Within 48 hours, they rally everyone willing to join the war. And within 72 hours, the United States steps in. This is absurd, but it's a very telling kind of absurd. What does it mean? For the past year, the West, Europe especially, kept saying one thing. We need reliable security guarantees, an immediate ceasefire and security guarantees. We asked them, if you're not solving the underlying issues, won't these guarantees just mean that any ceasefire gets used to pump more weapons into Ukraine? They didn't hear the logic, didn't respond to it at all. But now, under the current circumstances, when the Trump administration started engaging with the Ukraine question, by the way, the Trump administration's approach to Russia is seen in very mixed terms here. We have some romantic, some people prone to wishful thinking. I can say a few words about that later, but for now, back to Ukraine. The Trump administration did decide to address the root causes of the conflict.
Worried about what? What are you worried about with the Trump administration?
I can come back to that, but let me finish on security guarantees. From the start, they said they wanted to deal with root causes. President Trump publicly told Kiev to forget about NATO membership. He and his team started talking about recognizing realities on the ground. All of this was discussed in Alaska, and once again, we explained to our American counterparts that for us, it's not really about territory, not about land. What matters most is the people who live there, whose ancestors lived there. For centuries, these lands were settled by Russian people who spoke Russian, who raised their children in Russian. And these people in Crimea, in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions, as well as in the so-called Little Russia, in Kherson and the Zaporozhye regions, were labeled as subhuman by the putschists who came to power as a result of a coup d'etat. The then President Poroshenko openly told them to their faces, our children, Ukrainian children, will go to clean kindergartens, to spacious, bright schools. They will play while the children of those in Donbass, the children of those terrorists, will rot in basements. Zelensky, in 2021, long before the start of our operation, said in an interview answering a question about how he viewed those people on the other side of the front line that there are people and there are creatures. And if you live in Ukraine and feel connected to Russian culture, to Russian civilization, my advice to you, for the sake of your children and grandchildren, is to get the hell out to Russia. That is what lies at the root of the current authorities' attitude towards everything Russian, the language, the culture. And the fact that this regime, starting back in 2019 and continuing under Zelensky, has adopted about a dozen laws banning Russian language education at all levels, banning Russian culture, Russian media, and essentially all things Russian, banning the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and legalizing the theory and practice of Nazism, including the installation of monuments to individuals who were criminals convicted by the Nuremberg Tribunal. And when they tell us and continue to tell us about security guarantees, I have a simple question. Security guarantees for which state are we talking about? For the one where the Russian language is banned? The only country in the world where the Russian language is banned. In Israel, Arabic is not banned. In Palestine and in Arab countries, Hebrew is not banned. Nowhere is a language banned. But in Ukraine, not just any language is banned. The language of the indigenous people of those lands is banned. And if they want to use security guarantees to entrench precisely this regime, regardless of what territory it controls, then of course this is unacceptable. It would be even worse if they attempt to barter some limited concessions on the Russian language. That would be despicable. That would be dishonest because language rights and religious freedoms for Russian speakers are enshrined in the UN Charter. This is not a subject for bargaining. I would not even call this a precondition. One should simply say, Ukraine, you're a member of the United Nations. Please comply with the Charter. By the way, Ukraine's own constitution states that the state is obliged to respect the rights of the Russian language and of other national minorities. So when the West completely ignores the issue and speaks openly about giving Zelensky security guarantees, it means they want to preserve Zelensky and his neo-Nazi anti-Russian regime. And that is what is wrong. Returning now to our contacts with the Americans, whose 28 points that were conveyed to us before the Alaska meeting included provisions stating that the rights of national minorities and religious freedoms must be restored. But in the latest version, which we've not seen, but which Zelensky himself cites, he already speaks of 20 points. We have read some fragments, and there is nothing there about restoring the rights of Russians or other national minorities or religious freedoms. Instead, it says Ukraine will demonstrate tolerance in accordance with the norms of the European Union. Why is that? There are norms that go beyond the European Union, and there are norms within the European Union that are unacceptable to many countries around the world.
Because things are so difficult right now in Ukraine, the problems they're having with their energy grid, for example, yesterday, several officials, including a regional governor of Ukraine, told Mr. Zelensky publicly, let's do this deal. Sign where we are right now. For the good of the people of Ukraine, give up the territories that you are arguing about, and you need to do that for the good of the people of Ukraine. We're hearing this now from people in Ukraine who are saying this. That's really important. If somehow Mr. Zelensky can be talked into ceding that territory and giving Russia the security guarantees that it needs, i.e. no European troops in Ukraine, and the respect of the Russian heritage and religion, is that something that Russia can then live with and sign that deal and end this war? Are those, or am I missing something?
I've partly answered this question already when responding to the previous one, namely what kind of Ukraine we're prepared to see as a neighbor for the long term, for the future. It must be a friendly Ukraine, not necessarily allied with us, but neutral and benevolent. And this, of course, presupposes respect not only for the rights of the people living in the territory that will remain with Ukraine, not only respect for their access to the benefits of civilization like heating, food or water, but also respect for their fundamental human rights, including language, education and religion. I would like to emphasize once again, in the Ukraine that will be signing those agreements, norms of international law and the norms of Ukraine's own constitution must not be violated, the norms that guarantee the rights of national minorities. As for calls for a ceasefire, you know that hysteria has now erupted over claims that we are inhumanly cutting off electricity to cities, that people are suffering and freezing, and that Russia is striking energy facilities. We were never the first to start these actions. It was precisely the Ukrainians who were the first to strike our energy facilities and other civilian targets, including residential buildings, shops and hospitals. A year ago, a passenger train was blown up with no military component whatsoever. For some reason, however, people forget that there have been numerous examples of our goodwill. In March of last year, President Trump, in a conversation with President Putin, proposed declaring an energy ceasefire for 1 month. President Putin publicly supported this proposal the very same day. And for an entire month, March to April, we did not touch Ukraine's energy facilities at all. At the same time, during the very period, Zelensky's side attacked our energy facilities, entirely civilian ones, more than 130 times. I may not recall the exact figure now, but it was definitely over 130 attacks. So, you know, our conscience is clear and our patience is not limitless. If one knows the Russian character through proverbs like measure seven times, cut once, we spent a long time measuring. We drew our conclusions. And one of the conclusions, speaking of Alaska, we're now being offered something. I do not know what will be offered to our delegation in Abu Dhabi. Yesterday, I spoke with our colleagues who have gone there about this very idea, about those security guarantees that Mark Rutte spoke about so extensively yesterday in the Rada in Kiev. They had heard absolutely nothing about them. They learned about this from the Financial Times. And if this is what the Ukrainians went to today's talks with, then this is, of course, further confirmation that Zelensky does not need peace at all, that any peace, even a minimally honest and comprehensible one, would mean the end of his political career, and perhaps not only his political career. We will see what they will offer us. After his conversation with Rutte, Zelensky said, "I'm ready for compromises, but Russia must also be ready for compromises." This is such a shameless remark, but I'm not surprised, because this person has neither shame nor conscience and thinks of absolutely nothing except his own survival. To ensure that, he constantly needs to perform some kind of sketches on the international stage, which is precisely how he views it, as a stage. Now, about Alaska. Before Alaska, Steve Witkoff came to see us a week to 10 days beforehand. He brought a concrete proposal that included elements of compromise, and the president spoke about this publicly, so I'm not revealing any secrets here. And those proposals did not fully take into account a whole range of issues of fundamental importance to us, so we took them up for further work. And when we arrived in Anchorage and the two presidents sat down together with their accompanying officials, we said that this had been a difficult step for us, but that we were ready to accept the U.S. proposal, taking into account those elements of compromise. In essence, we accepted their proposal. After that, we waited a very long time for our American colleagues to announce that we'd reached an agreement and that this was the solution we'd settled on. Because by and large, their solution, the solution of the Trump administration, would have been sufficient for us. We were not interested in how Europe would react. We had a good idea of that. We're not interested in what Ukraine would say. Just like Europe, Ukraine would not be able to fight without U.S. weapons, intelligence data, and satellite targeting. And if the results of Anchorage had been announced, I'm confident everything would have moved quite quickly to a process of formalizing peace agreements. But we supported the proposal of the United States, and Europe immediately rushed to Washington with Zelensky and began reworking the U.S. initiative that had already been approved by President Putin. And they are still reworking it to this day. When our American colleagues drop by, you can sense that they want some additional concessions from our side. So essentially, I've listed you examples of our flexibility since 2004, in 2014, 2015, and 2022. And frankly, the president has said more than once that we remain ready for a diplomatic solution. We've never changed our conditions, unlike other participants in this process who constantly move the goalposts and say, now you also have to score one more goal here, but not score one there. But our positions are very clear and consistent.
Do you give the Trump administration credit for the dialogue that he's established with Russia? As imperfect as it may be, the fact is the previous administration didn't talk to you at all, didn't want to talk to you, and seemed to want to just continue the war. The Trump administration has established a dialogue. While we may be at a different place, Mr. Witkoff said in Davos that we were just very, very close to having a deal with Russia and Ukraine. It sounds like that is not the case. But you're talking, at least. For example, the START Treaty seems to be expiring soon. And will America and Russia come together and renew that deal? How important is that? Do you feel confident that you can bridge that conversation with the American team?
Of course, you know, the Trump administration has a fundamentally different view and understanding of the world and U.S. national interests, which is reflected in its attitude towards other countries, allies, competitors, and adversaries alike. And the fact that this administration is prepared to talk to everyone has been evident from its very first days in the White House, including in its contacts with Russia, which have continued in a wide variety of formats. And I remember very well a meeting in February of 2025, 1 month after President Trump entered the Oval Office, that I recently had an opportunity to speak about. We met with Marco Rubio and then National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, who is now the U.S. representative to the United Nations. I was there with Yuri Ushakov. And at that time, Marco Rubio said that the U.S. administration would be guided by national interests and that it recognizes that Russia also has national interests. And then common sense comes into play. What does that mean? The interests of two such major players will not always coincide. But when they do, it would be a mistake not to use that convergence and translate it into practical, tangible, mutually beneficial projects in energy, space, high technology, and so on. And when the interests of Russia and the United States do not coincide, which will happen far more often than they do, this divergence must not be allowed to degenerate into confrontation, let alone a hot conflict. I said that this was absolutely our approach, that we were ready to collaborate on a wide range of projects based on such a mutually respectful attitude towards one another. This same idea was repeatedly emphasized by the American delegations that came and met with President Putin both before and during the preparations for Alaska. To get to the main point, they said the conditions required to make these rosy prospects unfold boiled down to just one thing. We inherited Ukraine from Biden. He adopted an anti-Russian stance, and that's why Ukraine ended up at the forefront of the global agenda. We need to get rid of it. We need to settle it. We want to settle it, and we will work on this. I want to emphasize once again, they said this while demonstrating an understanding of our position. And once we're done with Ukraine, then we'll engage in mutually beneficial joint projects for the good of our peoples, both here and there.
Sanctions.
In this connection, I follow the remark. In Anchorage, we accepted the Trump administration's proposal on Ukraine. And if our agreement had been received in an open, above board and straightforward way, it should have meant that we had set Ukraine aside and removed it from our bright, straight road towards future cooperation and prosperity. But the settlement of the Ukraine conflict continues to be kept in play, and with ever new dimensions being added, which look like new conditions and demands being imposed on Russia. But the conversation continues. Once we've finished with this, everything will be better than you could have ever dreamed of, they say. Well, the Communist Party used to force us to dream. We dreamed of many things. So we do have a certain amount of experience in this. Still, we judge things by concrete actions. Speaking of concrete actions, you mentioned sanctions. Yes, these sanctions remain in place. Quite literally, in April of 2025, shortly after we established contact with the Trump administration, the U.S. law covering emergency situations in international affairs, originally adopted under Biden, was extended for another year. That law contained a provision requiring that Russia's gold and foreign exchange reserves remain frozen, while explicitly stating that this is in connection with Russia's hostile foreign policy. The renewal of that law was rubber-stamped. The administration took no steps to withdraw it, amend it, or explain the circumstances that have fundamentally altered our relations. Yes, the administration's understanding of what is happening differs strikingly from Biden's. But what is interesting is that this law requiring that our foreign exchange reserves remains frozen also cites as an example of our alleged hostile foreign policy. What do you think? Interference in the election of the president of the United States. That is the very thing that Biden, Obama, and their team essentially blamed on Trump, claiming that this was why Trump had been elected in the first place. It turns out that the Trump administration supported this notion by extending the law, thereby tacitly agreeing with the assertions that Russia interfered in the presidential elections, something President Trump publicly refutes every other day to this day. There were other things as well, of course. For example, the sanctions all remain in place. Moreover, very harsh sanctions have been imposed against our largest oil companies, Lukoil, Rosneft, for the first time. This happened a couple of weeks after the meeting in Anchorage, at which...
How does that make you feel?
The president was surprised by this and spoke about it in an interview. Once again, we parted ways in Anchorage on the understanding that Russia supported the United States' proposal for a comprehensive settlement of the Ukrainian crisis. And after that, we expected the United States to confirm it, to say, well, now you have agreed to our proposal. Let's announce something, convene a conference, sign something, form a peace council. But instead, sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft suddenly followed. Moreover, tariffs are also being imposed against countries that buy energy from Russia and Iran.
Yeah, two faces of Trump. It's like good Trump, bad Trump, right? At least with Biden, you only had bad Biden. But with Trump, you get... That's hard to figure out, I bet.
Now, following the developments in Venezuela, they're openly trying to push our companies from Venezuela. India is being banned from buying Russian oil. At least that's what was announced. There appears to be a worldwide ban both on oil and gas supplies. They say Russian oil and gas will be replaced by American oil and American liquefied natural gas. Just recently, a plan on Cuba was adopted. You'll certainly find it interesting. And it says that a state of emergency has been declared due to the threat Cuba poses to U.S. interests in the Caribbean, including due to Russia's hostile and malicious policies. Well, the bright future of our economic and investment cooperation doesn't really square with that.
Do you think that's Trump, or is that the administrative state and the neocons and the people who are very aggressive and anti-Russian because they make money off of wars and aggression? Those are the people controlling that, do you think? Or do you think it's Trump?
I don't know, because this is an internal matter. But there is a caveat. We understand perfectly well that the United States, with all its power, with all its ambitions, if you will, is forced to take into account the opinion of the administration and of a whole range of groups of people in its foreign and domestic policies. Domestically, a very large number of Democrats primarily, but also some Republicans, hold Russophobic positions. Of course, we can understand that the administration cannot ignore these factors in its actions. To maintain the loyalty of this Russophobic wing, it must take some anti-Russian steps. But the substance of these anti-Russian steps is quite serious. I can also imagine that the administration needs to somehow appease Europe, feeding something nice to Europe. If the administration's priority with regard to Europe is for Europe to listen to Washington and do what Washington says and buy what Washington says, weapons and liquefied natural gas at several times the price of Russian gas, well, perhaps in this situation, Russophobia, to a certain extent, is seen as the price to pay for the inconveniences the U.S. is creating for Europe. At the same time, the goal, by and large, is dominance in the global economy, including in energy. I think that's part of the national security strategy or some other strategy. And the wording may be a bit different, but the bottom line is clear.
It sounds like, and I'm glad to hear you say, you sound like you're optimistic. It sounds to me like you believe there is still the potential for a positive outcome, despite all the difficulties that we have just talked about and you've explained. There's one other area I want to ask you about, and that's Iran. It's in the news these days, and it's looking like Mr. Trump is pulling back from his aggressive stance and the talk of the armada. And I'm reading reports that your government, the Russian Federation, maybe yourself and Mr. Putin yourselves, may have been involved in some indirect or direct way in mediating that. That part of the reason things seem to be cooling a little bit or getting a little less tense is because maybe Russia was involved in helping the conversation between Iran and the Trump administration. What role have you played, if any, in that?
I believe everyone played a useful, decisive role in 2015 when the multi-year agreement on the Joint Comprehensive Program of Action on the Iranian nuclear program was being finalized. Ceilings for the amount of low-enriched uranium Iran could possess were agreed upon then, and everything above that, we took it over. It was part of the deal. Then, 3 years later, President Trump, in his first term, withdrew from the deal. That's when the accusations against Iran began. Iran never violated anything, but when the U.S. withdrew from the deal, all the upsides that Iran were interested in were gone. Iran found itself in a situation where it no longer had any commitments because those commitments were mutual and they were destroyed. Yes, and now Iran continues to enrich. At the same time, it did not violate the nuclear non-proliferation treaties. It did everything under the supervision of the IAEA. And yet it was attacked for 12 days by Israeli and American bombings. Against this background, the IAEA Director General, Mr. Grossi, certainly looks strange because the sites that Israel and the U.S. bombed are under the control of the IAEA. And the IAEA, represented by its Director General, is simply obliged to make some kind of political assessment that the sites are under our control and they were illegally bombed. This is dangerous and we are calling for... But they said nothing at all. This simply characterizes the current state of affairs within the IAEA management. But right now, we're not trying to force ourselves on Iran, Israel or the United States. But in our contacts with them, we're simply discussing the situation. Iran is our close partner, our neighbor. We care about how this situation develops. Moreover, it's explosive, not only for Iran itself, but for the entire Middle East. There are too many time bombs there, just waiting to be stepped on by a clumsy foot. The Iranians, Israelis, and Americans know that we are once again ready to offer our services in terms of contributing to the implementation of the agreement when, I hope, or if it is reached. It will in some way touch upon the issue of uranium enrichment and enriched uranium stockpiles, and we have the capacity to offer our services here. The parties are aware of these services, and now the most important thing is for them to reach an agreement.
Services in helping to make sure the Iranians agree to a new nuclear deal and the Americans agree to stop punishing the Iranian economy with these sanctions.
This should be negotiated between Iran and the United States. I hope they will not be interfered with. And if any specific steps are needed within the framework of this deal, in which Russia can be useful, including our experience with preserving uranium, we will be ready to take these steps. They all know this very well. We're not interfering in the substance of the negotiations now. Iran has once again publicly demonstrated through its president its interest in dialogue, with the understanding that it will be fair and aimed at a balance of interests. We're interested in this.
But without giving me specifics about what you spoke about, you are in conversations with the Iranian government.
Yes, and we recently spoke with the president on the phone. We also have contacts at the expert level.
You, sir, are so kind and so gracious to give us so much of your time. I know we've gone overboard a little bit, but I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.